You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Disease du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I talked to Dr. Ashley Boyle about managing strangles outbreaks. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Bimeda. Dr. Boyle obtained her DVM from Cornell University. She did her internship at Littleton Equine Medical Center and Surgical Center in Colorado and obtained her diplomacy in large animal internal medicine after completing her residency at UC Davis in 2004. She is a professor at Penn Vet New Bolton Center in the section of field service. Her research interests include infectious disease with a focus on Streptococcus equi, subspecies equi, and the testing methods associated with diseases to help improve herd management. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Boyle.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to talk about strangles outbreaks with you today. It's something that's common, but that nobody ever wants to deal with. To get us started, can you just review the pathogenesis of strangles and sort of broadly explain how this begins to inform our control and prevention strategies?
Yeah, so it's caused by the bacteria Streptococcus equi, subspecies equi, otherwise known as Streptococcus equi or Strep equi. It's closely related, but not the same thing as Streptococcus zooepidemicus, and which can cause other respiratory illnesses and can also be a normal pathogen. But Strep equi is not a normal pathogen in the respiratory tract of the horse, and it enters through the palatine tonsils and the pharyngeal tonsils and goes into the neighboring lymph nodes, which would be the subendymal lymph nodes and the retropharyngeal lymph nodes. So the subendymal lymph nodes are under the jaw and the retropharyngeal lymph nodes are basically behind the jaw underneath the guttural pouch, which is an outpouching of the eustachian tube in the horse. And it tends to be typically an upper respiratory infection. So it can cause nasal discharge, the swelling of the lymph nodes, a fever, and basically upper respiratory catarrh, which is another way of describing all of those previous symptoms.
At what point in this process do horses become contagious, and how long do they remain contagious?
Okay, well, why don't I first start by the fact that it can take about 3 to 14 days for them to get infected. So that's the incubation period. And so the first symptom typically is a fever, a high fever of like 103 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. And those horses, if you catch the fever immediately, so if you were monitoring the horse's temperature daily or twice daily and caught that fever right away, you have about 48 hours before they become contagious. And they will actually potentially remain contagious for quite some time. So that can be many weeks. And that depends on the degree of shedding that they're doing when they're actually sick, which can usually last when they're showing the nasal discharge and the swelling of their lymph nodes and so forth. That can last for about 2 to 3 weeks, but they can remain contagious for much longer because the bacteria can hang out in the guttural pouch, which is that air pocket in the back of their throat. And the way that that usually happens is that the bacteria from the retropharyngeal lymph nodes erupts into the guttural pouch, and then it can intermittently shed from the guttural pouch into the nasal passage. So there are times when horses can remain positive for many months to potentially up to years after having an infection, depending on whether they keep that bacteria in that guttural pouch. And they will intermittently shed into the nasopharynx or into their throat, and then intermittently shed into the environment and into the neighboring horses. So they tend to be what we believe to be the source of these outbreaks, and they can be silent carriers. So they can, the horse that is shedding for many months to up to years may actually look normal on the outside. Typically, the horses can shed for like 6 weeks, but you can have horses that shed longer, like I was describing.
Right. What are some of the major routes of transmission for the bacteria? And does that change based on if you have a symptomatic horse or an asymptomatic shedder?
Yeah, so the typical routes of transmission are close contact or potentially fomites. And fomites are things that actually can carry the bacteria on the surface for potentially a period of time. And obviously the horse that is actively sick is going to shed more bacteria, and that risk of infection is much higher. And a common place that can be a fomite is actually a water bucket. So if you have, for example, an outbreak and you have horses that are in a field, in a paddock, that have a shared water, not only are these horses that are living together in close contact touching nose to nose, and that's one way to transmit the disease, but then they're also sharing that water bucket, and the bacteria likes wet environments. So that's why water buckets can be a definite source of infection. And that means that if they share a water bucket between paddocks, even if they can't actually touch noses, they can actually transmit the disease as well. And other things that can be fomites are, you know, shared tack, like bits on bridles and other equipment that is shared. There have been studies that have looked at the bacteria in the environment, and it doesn't seem to stick around in the environment when it's exposed to the elements for very long, such as being exposed to sunlight or even rain on like fence posts and so forth. There was a study out of Canada many years ago that looked at that, and they could not actually recover it from the fence posts after a couple of days. But there have been more recent studies that have looked at shared equipment, especially if it's in a cold environment and a wet environment, that is more likely to hold on to the bacteria for longer. And an example was like a wet nasogastric tube, you know, a piece of equipment that a veterinarian could use. If it's not cleaned properly, it could stick around in the environment for up to like 30 days in that kind of wet environment if that nasogastric tube is not cleaned and dried properly.
Wow. Yeah, I feel like that's something that we don't always think about, especially clients probably don't realize how they're putting other horses at risk through maybe just like shared tack or a shared tack ram. So definitely an important thing to keep in mind. This podcast is brought to you by Bimeda, the manufacturer of GastroBim. GastroBim, omeprazole, is the first and only FDA-approved bioequivalent to GastroGuard. Give your horse a scientifically proven, apple-flavored solution for gastric ulcers. Because equine gastric ulcer syndrome is complex, always work with your veterinarian for proper diagnosis and care. Same trusted treatment, less cost. That's GastroBim. The safety of GastroBim paste has not been determined in pregnant or lactating mares. For use in horses and foals 4 weeks of age and older. If you have a strangles outbreak at a facility, what should your first step be as a veterinarian when you're responding to this outbreak?
Well, so, I mean, the most challenging situation is actually that first horse that you don't know is actually definitely positive for strangles. And, but that horse would potentially have symptoms that may point you in that direction. So some kind of respiratory symptoms, but even a fever alone should be something to set some alarm bells off that this might be strangles. And other ways to kind of clue into that would be whether they have recent travel history on the farm, new horses arriving, you know. But so, I mean, there are many things that can cause a fever in a horse, but strangles should potentially be on the list, especially if your population is coming and going. And so one of the most important things is to actually test these horses as well as isolate these horses. And that can be hard to sometimes do in certain settings, depending on what the facilities are, whether there is a place to put this horse. But as I mentioned earlier, if you can actually isolate the horse quickly, and then the other thing to do is to recommend having the other horses, having their temperatures taken ideally twice a day, if not once a day, to test all the horses that, you know, to take the temperatures of all the horses that are in close contact, if not all the horses on the property, if feasible, to identify horses that might be exposed or have been exposed, and then moving them into that isolation area as well. And that isolation area can be a makeshift round pen with, you know, some kind of shelter. I've made isolation facilities out of, you know, making a paddock an isolation facility and then not using the nearby paddocks, or if they have an alleyway in between. Sometimes I've made, depending on how many horses seem to be affected, making the barn the affected area and keeping all the other horses outside. So there's a lot of ways to do it. And you really can actually minimize the exposure by separating the horses. And then, you know, trying to identify what is going on. So that can be done, you know, a couple of different ways, and it may not come back positive right away, especially if that first horse is identified early on. So remember, they can not shed for about 48 hours, and so you may not pick up the organism on testing immediately. And so sometimes repeated testing is required, or repeated sampling from the same horse can be required because of, you know, the timing of when the sample is taken.
What type of diagnostic testing do you typically recommend?
So it can depend on, you know, what stage of the disease you're dealing with. So the horse that is overtly sick and having nasal discharge, or having lymph node enlargement, especially the horse with the lymph node enlargement, one of the best places to take that sample is actually from that lymph node. So if the lymph node is ready to be aspirated with a needle and syringe, that can be the best place to take the sample. But that you may identify that horse or suspect that horse before the lymph nodes are evident. So I like to take samples from the nasopharynx or the guttural pouch, but the guttural pouch might actually not be infected yet early on. So the nasopharynx is a good place to take the sample, and that can be done with a nasopharyngeal wash. Usually we recommend sedating the horse for that sample. In a horse that's, you know, has a lot of nasal discharge, a nasal pharyngeal swab might actually be enough of a sample to take. Sometimes you can get a sample from what we call a rostral nasal swab, which is a sample that is only about 6-inch swab that would only be taken from the nose, basically like the beginning of the nose, instead of going deep into the nasopharynx. And that can be taken a little more easily without sedation, but those can be falsely negative. And even the nasopharyngeal swab can be falsely negative if there is not enough discharge that is evident, you know, from the horse at that time. And then it depends on what you're going to do with that sample. So the most sensitive sample would be a polymerase chain reaction, so a PCR, which is testing for the DNA. And you can do that on any of the samples that you're taking. And we've actually shown that, and so have other people, that the PCR is definitely more sensitive than the culture, but it's often useful to run both samples. So you can run a PCR and a culture on the same sample, depending on how your lab works. And the advantage of that is you will get the cycle count number of the PCR. So it can tell you whether you're detecting a low number of DNA versus a high number of DNA based on that number from the PCR. And the way that number works is the higher the number, the lower the amount of DNA has been detected. And the reason for that is that basically the machine, it's how many cycles the machine had to run to find that DNA and to find that bacteria sample. But the benefit of the culture is multifold. One, you can use it for culture insensitivity if you're having a difficult time treating a horse, and it can be also used for genetic testing or genomic testing, and as well as, you know, determining what bacteria isolate it is, which you cannot do on the PCR samples, on the extractions that you do for PCR.
Okay. Once you have a confirmed case or confirmed cases, do you typically go in and start recommending treatments? Do you let the disease run its course? What would your approach be to managing some of these confirmed positive cases?
Yeah, so it really depends on the horse and what's going on with that particular horse. It's actually not recommended to treat these horses with antibiotics automatically, because often you actually have to treat them for an extended period of time. If they, depending on where they are in their stage of the disease, especially if they already have the lymph node enlargement, it can actually, the treatment with antibiotics can actually prolong those swellings and make them take longer to mature and abscess and rupture. And it just kind of prolongs the course of the total disease. And so we really are recommending doing antibiotics for the welfare of the horse. And so basically what that means, if the horse needs antibiotics because they are having trouble eating despite treating them with non-steroidals, so bute or phenylbutazone or megalamine, and basically you're using those non-steroidals to lower their fever, make them feel better, to not have the sore throat feeling, so that they do want to eat and drink, and they can, and basically you're providing them supportive care, and you may want to feed them softer food such as mashes plus or minus wet hay to encourage them to eat and to basically provide them with supportive care. And so the times that we think about antibiotics would be more often for the horses that are not eating well, despite that treatment with the non-steroidals for many days, or they're still spiking that 105 degree Fahrenheit fever before the next dose of non-steroidals is due, and they're really feeling crappy and not eating or not drinking. The other scenario would be horses that are having complications associated with the disease. So horses that have metastatic strangles, which is bastards, otherwise known as bastard strangles, where they are getting abscesses in other parts of their body, and or the swelling is so bad that the swelling of the lymph nodes is so bad that you're worried about their airway getting narrowed. And sometimes that swelling is actually inside their body. You can't actually see it outside their body. And so sometimes those retropharyngeal lymph nodes can get so large that their airway is narrowed. And we actually have to provide them with a tracheostomy so that they can breathe. And at the same time, you're trying to treat the abscesses with antibiotics to try to get them smaller so that they can breathe. Another scenario would be if you had complications like purpura hemorrhagica, which is a activity to the disease, which can happen due to a second exposure to the disease, or sometimes after some vaccinations, if they've had a recent exposure to strangles and then they get vaccinated thereafter with certain vaccines. And those horses will actually get a high fever, have clotting disorders that result in lesions in their mucous membranes. Sometimes if they have pink skin, you can see the lesions on their skin, and they can have other swellings in their body as a reaction to having this hypersensitivity. And those horses often need corticosteroids as well as antibiotics. The thing that we try to discourage is preventative antibiotics, because that actually gives you a false sense of security, and they tend to actually still be like, there are a couple studies that have shown that horses that have been treated with antibiotics, whether it's warranted antibiotics or not, they can actually come down with the disease again because they don't mount as good of immune response. So that's where you get that false sense of security if you treat preventatively with antibiotics.
Once you have the horse sort of through the active disease process, what is the next step for confirming that they're actually completely strangles free? Do you typically like to go into the guttural pouches and just confirm that they're no longer shedding? What is the role of that in this whole outbreak process?
Yeah, so I mean, that is what I would consider the gold standard to determine that they are not shedding anymore. And the reason that I say that is because you can actually go into the guttural pouch with an endoscope, with a camera, and actually make sure that there are no lesions inside the guttural pouch. And so even if your horse comes back negative on the testing, if they have congealed pus or chondroids in that guttural pouch, I mean, there have been scenarios where I have seen chondroids in the guttural pouch and their PCR has come back negative. So by visually looking into the guttural pouch, you are confirming that it looks clean as well as being PCR plus culture clean. But there are, you know, disadvantages or roadblocks to doing the guttural pouch sampling, because sometimes people don't have the endoscope available. Sometimes they are not as comfortable getting into the guttural pouch. And so there are some other ways that you can test these horses. You can do repeated nasopharyngeal washes. I would recommend washes over swabs, and I would definitely recommend nasal pharynx testing over the nostril nasal swabs, but you do usually need multiple samples when you're just doing the nasopharynx, because you're trying to catch when that guttural pouch is shedding the bacteria into the nasopharynx intermittently. Sometimes people have also used imaging such as radiographs to see if they can see guttural or see chondroids into the or in the guttural pouch if they don't have an endoscope, but that's not as high yield. But there is one paper that a big farm did that on some horses that they were suspicious of, and it did that for ease of imaging. I guess it was easier for those particular horses, maybe behaviorally, to take x-rays or radiographs instead of the endoscope. But the gold standard would be to take a sample with a lavage of the guttural pouch through the endoscope, and so that you're looking as well as sampling.
And if you do have a persistent carrier, what would the next step be for sort of managing that horse and making it so that they are no longer a shedder?
Yeah, so this it can be quite challenging, because what can happen is that you can have a horse that is PCR positive and culture negative, and you say, well, what do you do with that horse? And what do you do with the horse that is positive on both? And right now, we still don't know. We know what an infective dose can be as far as in the research setting, but we don't necessarily know what the infective dose can be from a silent shedder or a silent carrier. And so, you know, is the horse that is PCR positive and culture negative, so has a low amount of bacteria in their sample, are they infective? And basically, I would say that they probably, or you should assume that they are until proven otherwise, because there have been scenarios where horses have been PCR positive, culture negative, and they've gone into naive populations and have infected and caused an outbreak. So what to do with these horses? Lavage is definitely one of the mainstays of treatment. So physically lavaging these horses, especially if they have or pus of some sort, whether it's chondroids or not, they don't have to be the solid rocks, to lavage that gross material out of the guttural pouch. Time is also a big issue or a big factor. So sometimes these horses will remain positive for a while, and the problem is that, and understandably, people want to reopen their barns and have the outbreak declared over so that they can move around and do their competitions and so forth. And sometimes it takes a while. So having them in a separate facility is helpful. Sometimes treating them with antibiotics can be helpful. You can have the veterinarian treat them locally into the guttural pouch, but sometimes that doesn't work. So sometimes I've had to treat them systemically with antibiotics. And you know, the antibiotic of choice is penicillin for both those things. But that can be challenging as well, because penicillin is given intramuscularly or IV when you give it systemically, and sometimes you have to do it for an extended period of time, and those horses, you know, are not, it's not the most pleasant experience for the horses to get repeat, you know, twice a day antibiotics in the muscle.
Yeah, it's definitely a tricky situation for those horses. What are some of the current best practices that you recommend for preventing strangles outbreaks in the first place when introducing new horses to the property? I know a lot of facilities will simply quarantine new horses for a couple of weeks, but do you think that's actually sufficient, or would you recommend that every horse undergo a guttural pouch endoscopy?
So the practicality of every horse going under a guttural pouch endoscopy is probably not realistic. I think that people have to take into consideration where the horse is coming from, and also whether their history is known or not, and then bringing them into quarantining them to some extent, you know, and like I said, that can be a variety of settings. You know, a lot of places don't actually have a quarantine barn, so it can be a separate paddock that hopefully has some shelter for that animal. And I would recommend that be for 3 weeks. And even though the incubation period for strangles is said to be up to 14 days, that there are other diseases that that incubation period is a little longer, and equine herpes virus one is being one of those. So you're protecting against multiple diseases by doing that. So what I often find is that people don't quarantine them for long enough. They might do it for a week or 2 weeks, and that probably is not sufficient. That way you can see whether the horse comes down with any clinical disease for any of these infectious diseases that horses can get. And checking their temperature daily is also very useful, because you might have the same person taking care of that horse that's also taking care of the other horses. Horses that I usually recommend getting, definitely recommend getting a guttural pouch, is, you know, at the end of their quarantine. So you give them some time to potentially develop disease. It would be horses that are coming from sale barns and the horses that don't have a history that come with them, or maybe have a limited history or unreliable history. And that way you're protecting yourself at another level for those horses. And, you know, there's probably no point, and it would be not a good use of money to actually do the testing as soon as they enter the quarantine. It's better to do it at the end of the quarantine, because then if something is happening or starting to happen, then you're more likely to catch it on that sample. And if it is going to not be an endoscopic guided guttural pouch lavage, then you could do multiple samples in that 3 week period and try to catch some when they are intermittently shedding. The problem is that you have the horse that may have, you know, chondroids that it looks perfectly happy, and it's had those chondroids for over a year. And so that's where going into the guttural pouch is helpful. So,
yeah, that's a great point about waiting until closer to the end of quarantine to start doing your testing. What role does vaccination play in all of this? Because I know that, you know, that's not necessarily one of our core vaccines, but do you typically recommend strangles vaccination for horses? Do you find it effective? And is it actually helpful during an active outbreak, or is that something you need to do before an outbreak ever even occurs at your property?
Yeah, so there's two vaccines available in the United States currently. There's an intramuscular vaccine and an intranasal vaccine, and they're both based on the strep M protein, which is a protein that is on the surface of the bacteria. And so, and I say that, I mentioned those specific things because there are some newer vaccines now available in Europe that are not based on the SM protein, and that'll play a role in the answer about outbreak vaccination during outbreaks. But as far as your first question, I mean, I usually do recommend it for horses that are obviously I'm practicing in the United States, so I'm using either the intranasal or the intramuscular vaccine, and I recommend it for horses that are going places. I recommend it usually for horses that are at boarding stables, because the horses are, even if their horse may not be going places, the horses are coming and going from that boarding stable. And there tends to be a lot of activity, and they may intermittently share stalls or share paddocks, and therefore sharing waters and other equipment. And I think if the vaccine is used properly, it can be pretty effective. And so one, that means that they have to have the initial series if they've never seen the vaccine before. So that depends on the vaccine, but that's usually one vaccine and then another vaccine a couple of weeks later. And then we've done some work where we actually recommend testing horses prior to the strangles vaccine if they have have an unknown history, or if they have been in an outbreak definitely within the last year. And, you know, probably the safest thing to do is to actually test them for their SEM titer prior to using an SEM protein vaccine, which would be the two that are available in the U.S. And what that tells you is whether the horse has a high titer already to that SEM protein. And if they already do, then if they have a value of 1 to 3200 or higher, then we don't recommend vaccinating them. It does not guarantee protection, but it's because it's a measure of something in their blood, and a lot of the protection is at the nasal level, the nasal mucosal level. And so it kind of depends on what the antibody levels would be at their nasal level, at the mucosa. And that's not something that's regularly available, but it at least tells you whether, you know, they're more likely to have a problem with the vaccine. So that leads me into the question about whether to vaccinate in the face of an outbreak. And the concerns are that if the horse has been recently exposed to the bacteria, to strangles, then they maybe are mounting a response already. And then if you vaccinate them in the face of the outbreak, you know, while the outbreak is already going on, then there is a higher chance that these horses will be hyper responders, have this autoimmune reaction that I mentioned before, and develop purpura. And sometimes it's hard in an outbreak situation in a facility to actually determine which horses are actually truly exposed. So, you know, I've heard of scenarios where people have vaccinated horses that they didn't think were directly exposed, and they still had some problems, and they may have been exposed through fomites or people, you know, being fomites or something that is hidden and they didn't know. So that's why I would not recommend vaccinating in the face of outbreak, because you don't always know what the exposure level is. In Europe, there's a new vaccine that is not based on the M protein, the SEM protein. And so there have been multiple clinical uses. It's not labeled for the use during an outbreak, but there are many people who are using it in the face of the outbreak and not having any problems. And the theory is that that is why. So with the U.S. vaccines and the SM protein, the M protein vaccines, you would actually want them to have had the full series and then a couple of weeks of after that last vaccine before they have full protection, you know, before you're putting them in this scenario where they could be exposed. No vaccine is going to be 100% protective. So for practicing good biosecurity, you know, not sharing buckets, not sharing equipment, not letting your horse touch noses at the show ring are good practices. Yeah. And then there's another titer that is used in other countries that looks at, there's another blood test that looks at some other proteins besides the SEM protein, but in our research, we haven't found it to be that useful in the setting where the SEM protein vaccines are used, because the horses that are vaccinated with the SEM proteins are, or the M protein vaccines are, going to come up positive on that titer, as well as the horses, as well as the SEM titer in the U.S. So the European titer has been used as potentially, could you identify horses earlier in an outbreak? But I haven't found titers very helpful in the outbreak situation, because they have to have some time to develop.
Okay, yeah, that's good to know. If for veterinarians who are managing outbreaks. What advice do you have for tracing exposed horses across facilities and coordinating with state officials where strangles is reportable? And what role does genomic sequencing play in outbreak tracing?
Yeah, so, I mean, the genomic sequencing can be very useful in kind of a research setting, partly because it's not readily available to all veterinarians. And so it's only certain places that can run it. You actually, as I mentioned earlier, you have to use the bacteria isolates. So you have to use the culture samples, like what's been grown up in culture. So you can't use the PCR samples. And it's not cheap. And it's not necessarily, like I said, readily available, so it can't always be done real time. So researchers in Sweden have done a really good job of answering this kind of question, where they've actually been able to trace back the isolates and then they did history questioning. But this happened over a year's time period, and they were able to identify that horses were identified from certain properties, or that they were on certain horse trailers and were transported from certain, from other countries and so forth. And that was able to be done in that setting because the whole country of Sweden has the disease as reportable. And so they were able to trace back that way. But in the reality of, at least in the U.S., a lot of states, it's not actionable. So it's reportable everywhere, but it's different levels of reportable. So in some states, it's only reportable by the lab, and the lab sends it to the state, and they send it in like batch samples or batch reporting. You can do a lot of voluntary reporting through the equine disease network, through the AAP. And so that can be voluntarily reported by a veterinarian or confirmed by a veterinarian once it's been reported by a layperson. But it's not actionable in every single state. And what I mean by that is that the state vet doesn't necessarily get involved with every single outbreak in every single state. And so a lot of the quarantines in the states where it's not actionable, it's on the honor system. And so it's recommended that the veterinarian, recommends to the property and the barn managers that they don't have the horses go anywhere or have any new horses come anywhere. But I mean, it would be advisable to voluntarily report those to the EDDC, and so that people know what's out there. And it usually is only reported at the level of the county. So, but people have strong opinions about that because sometimes people feel that it can be, makes their property identifiable and so forth. But there's been a lot of work, especially in Europe, about getting rid of the stigmatism associated with having a strangles outbreak and being open about it so that it doesn't spread because people don't move their horses.
Yeah, it's tricky. I feel like you hear stories all the time about horses leaving facilities during strangles outbreaks and going to a horse show and creating larger issues. So I know it's a tough thing, and the veterinarian attending the outbreak can only do so much when you're not in a state where there's a state mandated quarantine. So it's really going to be up to sort of everyone's goodwill at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. We did a study, like a survey. I mean, it was based on only the people who responded to the survey, and we did one that was for veterinarians and one that was for horse owners and associated people, affiliated people. And it was actually, it was surprising that actually more people want it to be more open and potentially more actionable, but, you know, that may have been population bias because of, you know, it was people who were interested and wanted to fill out the survey. So,
yeah, because the other side of that is that, you know, when it's, if it's not really open, then there's a lot of speculation that'll go around online and rumors spread, and, you know, that doesn't help the situation either. So, is there anything else that you would like to add on managing strangles outbreaks before we wrap up today?
I think the one of the key things is practicing good biosecurity, which is not just cleaning after the fact. It's, you know, the practices to help prevent. So, you know, whether that includes vaccination, but it also includes the behaviors of, you know, not putting your horse at risk if not needed. And I mean, the way infectious diseases spread, you know, has to do with a balance between, you know, the horse's immune system as well as the load that they're exposed to. So if they are minimally exposed, their immune system might be able to fight something off. And so, I mean, strangles is highly contagious. So that means that doesn't take a lot of exposure to result in the spread of disease, but, you know, everything you can do can be helpful, and separating the horses into, you know, an isolated group, such as, you know, and then you kind of label them as the red group. And then you have a orange or amber group that is, you know, horses that have been exposed that you know of. And then you have a green group that isn't, you know, horses that you don't think have been exposed, but might have been exposed, can do a lot for preventing the spread of the disease. And I'm actually not the one who came up with that. That was the researchers at the Animal Health Trust in the UK. And so, but basically it's, you know, it's isolating. And the, a lot of people want to say, well, let's just let it run its course. They're already exposed, but you can do a lot by taking the time to take the temperatures and separate those horses and then move them into their appropriate categories. And doing that daily, it's a lot of work, but it can really limit the disease on a farm.
Yeah, that's a great point, because even though strangles isn't usually deadly, it's still a really unpleasant experience for the horses that have it. So I think, you know, taking every effort you can to limit the exposure is probably going to benefit all the horses on that property.
Yeah. And the more horses that have it, the longer the outbreak is going to last, and the longer that's going to close a property down. And, you know, and that obviously has financial implications as well.
Definitely a lot of economic impacts associated with the disease. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Boyle, for coming on the podcast and talking about strangles outbreaks with us.
My pleasure.
I would like to say thank you again to Dr. Boyle for joining us, and thank you to Bimeda for supporting this episode. As always, thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Disease du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please send me an email at csisson@equinenetwork.com.